Okay, you'll forgive me. This is like a singer's moment. You know, you have this little mic hanging in front of your mouth. I totally wrecked that moment because, as you can see, there's a lovely piece of tape here because God has blessed me with freakishly small ears, and there has not been a microphone made that fits around the ear that stays on this head with these ears. So it requires tape, which just kills that Janet Jackson moment that I could be having right now. I am going to ask somebody to give me like a 15-minute clock. Would you give me a 15-minute, like, yes. Something like okay. That? Okay. 15 minutes. Can you hear me?
Can you hear? Yeah. Well, they want you to speak loud.
All right. Thank you. Well, I can get loud, so really, it's okay. You don't want to do that. Don't do that. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to speak here. Thank you all for coming. That's very kind. That truly, I thought, you know, it's so much easier to go speak to a room of people you don't know about a subject that is not you than to talk about you. So I was really excited about coming until I realized you all want to hear about me. I'm not that exciting. So I thought, okay, well, all right, if you want to hear my story, I'll tell you, but it's not really like a great story. I don't know what makes a great story great, but it is my story. And I love my story. So I'm happy to share it with you with two caveats. Caveat number one. I share this with great humility, and so if there's anything laudable that you hear, anything praiseworthy, really, don't give me much credit. Don't give me much credit at all, because I could change that in a heartbeat. If there's anything too sin-filled, too disgraceful, too that you hear, don't blame Jesus for that. Really, don't hold him accountable for that. Have faith. Add me to your prayer list. Because see, I'm still breathing. So I have great hope because God can do great things. If I've got breath, there's great hope. So please, add me to your prayer list. But I'll start with where I am. I'm 52 years old. And with 52 years of life behind me, there's a whole lot that I could share if you want to talk me to talk about my life. Yet, I'm going to drop it down to the biggies. And we'll just talk about the biggies. That I can't tell you all the ways that God has sustained my soul, that he saved my bacon, that he's transformed my life, but I can tell you the high points where here's marked change. It could have gone south, but God. It could have stayed south, but God. So, since life is filled with other people, all of our lives are filled with people, I'm going to do my best to just tell my story. And yet there are going to be names of other people that come into my story. You can't tell your story without other people's names. Hopefully you can't. And yet, I want you to know that anybody else's name that appears in my story is beloved by me. That they have been used by God to write my story. So even if some of the things they were used to write are absolutely downright straight from the left side of the pit of hell, I would change nothing. And I do not blame them. I do not hold them accountable for being the darkness in my life. Because truly without that darkness, I would not know my Jesus the way I know him. I know Jesus. I'll say it one more time. I know Jesus. And no one can change that. And I know that darkness can make a whole lot of noise. And it can cover so much that's good. But Jesus always breaks through darkness. It's just who he is and what he does. He is light. He is life. He is love. Jesus. My favorite verse, I have to read it to you in the Amplified Version. Philippians 3:10. This verse came to me when I was 16 years old, and as I look at the verse now, And then as I reflect back, as I look at 52 years of life, I can see God. I don't know how he does this thing with time, you know, where he stands here and time can go everywhere and he can be in all of it at one time. Philippians 3:10, it's as though he told it to me when I was 16, and yet he was doing it from beginning to now. And I assume he'll be doing it until I go to meet him. So Philippians 3:10 says, "For my determined purpose is that I may know him, that I may progressively become more deeply and intimately acquainted with him, perceiving and recognizing and understanding the wonders of his person more strongly and more clearly, and that I may in that same way come to know the power outflowing from his resurrection, which it exerts over all believers, and that I may so share his sufferings as to be continually transformed in spirit into his likeness, even to his death, in the hope that if possible, I may attain to the spiritual and moral resurrection that lifts me out from among the dead, even while I'm in this body." That's awesome. That's just awesome. I love that verse. I love that verse. I'm 52 years old. I've been married to the most wonderful man I've ever met for 15 years. He's very human, but he's wonderful. And while we were never blessed with children, we have 7 nieces and nephews, now all under the age of 14. And I love being an aunt. I can rock being an aunt. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. I was raised in Ann Arbor. I went to Ann Arbor Huron, graduated with a Bachelor of Music from the University of Michigan, and just as my father predicted, I have never earned a living as a musician. I did get to experience the year of oatmeal. You wonder what that is? That's the year of poverty, where you eat oatmeal for breakfast, for lunch, and for snacks. It's the year of oatmeal, because I was determined I was going to be an amazing musician, and, you know, oatmeal. So, fortunately for me, though, I did work to put myself through college, and I worked as a research assistant. And so that kind of gave me the entree into, you know, business administration, all that good stuff, which then led to an actual career, not in music. So prior to becoming the executive director of Arbor Vitae Women's Center, I spent about 25 years in marketing and public relations in the Washington, D.C. area. And it was my job to grow companies, to take people from obscurity to sitting right in the center of the public eye. And I did my job well, and I enjoyed my job. And I enjoyed the crazy of my job. But as I'll tell you later, the crazy kind of took over me. I thought I was running it, but it ran me. Until 2004, Joe and I lived in Germantown, Maryland, and honestly, up until 6 months before the day we moved, if you had asked me, "Will you ever live in Michigan again?" I would have told you, no, never, no, never, no, never. But what brought me back was that I'm the oldest of 3 children. My siblings and their families and my mom all live within 45 minutes of where we are right now. And at the time, they had really young families, all under the age of 10, and their families were growing. So I was getting the calls, you know, the calls. "We think mom had a mini stroke. What do we do? We're not sure about who the executor of her will is. Do you know? We're not even sure if she has a will. What do we do?" So the calls were coming, and all Joe and I could think is, okay, either I'll lose my job because I'll be flying back and forth so much, or we've got to move. So we decided, you know, let's think about it. I called my mom on a Thursday saying, "Mom, we're thinking about moving." The realty section where houses are listed and apartments are listed, that was FedExed and arrived at my house by Friday. The reason we could move, like start to finish, we had a house that wasn't even on the market. It had needed some painting. It needed landscaping. The reason we could move, and we had not even thought about where we would live in Michigan. We knew nothing about Michigan other than I grew up in Ann Arbor. But the reason we could actually go from start to finish, moving, selling a house, buying a house, was because the realty section was with me by Friday. My mom said, you know anything, anything you need me to do, I'll do. Which meant, you give me a list of 20 properties that you want to see, I'll check them all out. And then I'll call you and tell you, of the 20, don't even worry about these 10. Just think about these 10 and then work the numbers on those. My mom did all of the legwork. All of the legwork. So the guy that got the commission when we bought our house in Dundee really should split it with my mother because she deserves some of that money. So literally within 6 months, start to finish, we moved. In 2004, this was our new home. And while that was a big thing in my life, I saw God all over that move. It was clear because it was like riding a wave. Once we got on, it took us. The key was just don't get off the board. Just stay on the wave. Don't even ask a question. Just go. And we were there. We were here. But my roots is where really things start. That I was born on August 5th, 1960. I was born to a black man who had no desire to be a father, nor did he have any desire to be a husband. As a result, he abandoned my mom and I when we needed him most. And in the eyes of the law, when it came time for him to own his child, he absolutely abdicated his position. So if you look at my birth certificate where it says father's name, there's nothing there. And back in that day, excuse my directness, I was a bastard child, and that was not a positive thing. So for the first, through middle school, when people would say, your father? Oh, I'm sorry, he's dead. He died before I was born. That was the only way I could cover my shame. I was born also, though, to a beautiful, intelligent, 20-year-old single black woman who at that time was not planning on being a mother. She was actually planning on being a model. My mom was well on her way. She was living in Chicago working at Spiegel's, which at the time was the fashion house for the American woman. My mom was, I've seen the pics. My love for shoes, purses, and hot clothes comes straight through my jeans. I mean, my mom was the woman. She was on her way to living her dreams. And so when she found out that she was pregnant, she knew for a fact that to choose life for her child was means she was going to say no to all of her dreams. She was going to change all of that for me. Unlike today, my mom's choice to be a single mom was radical. Today, 41% of all the children born in the United States are born to single moms. In the 1960s, 5%. She was choosing to be a social outcast, to say yes, to be a mom. I know that I understand the sin of conceiving a child out of wedlock. And yet, I'm sorry, I owe my mom an eternal thank you. Thank you for being courageous enough not just to give me life, but to choose to be my mom. Thank you. When I was 5, we moved in with a woman who, at the time, I really honestly believed she was my great, great grandmother. We called her Mother Bell. And God used her to give me a foundation that would keep me throughout my entire life. It keeps me today. Now do the math. Great, great, grandma. If my mom is 20 and you keep adding those greats, she was, no offense, she was old. She was like 80 years old. I mean, what? She was old, but she was amazing. I mean, the woman was amazing. She was, here's this little old black woman with some Indian blood in her, so she had braids that went way down below her rear end that she would braid and then doing the windy, 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 windy bun. And she did that every day. She took it down. She braided it up. Every day. They owned their own home on the outskirts of Chicago. It was fenced in. They had this, what to me at the time was a huge garden. It might just be as big as 6 tiles here, but to me it was huge when I was 5. And even though the house was really, really small and really, really old, it had indoor plumbing. It had a wood-burning stove, and it was clean. I remember, that was impressive to me. It was really clean, and it was really orderly. Like, there was a place for everything. It had feather, everything. It had feather beds. It had feather pillows. It had feather comforters. It had feather everything, except there were just no loose feathers around the house because it was so stinking clean. It had one of those gigantic old antique upright pianos. You know, the one that takes like 20 really big men to move and they still can't move it? This piano was huge, and she would play hymns on that thing, and she would just sing, and it just filled her soul. It was soft, it was sweet, it was quiet, but there was something going on that was beyond music. She gave me my love for music. She also gave me a love for the word. It's the first thing I ever recall reading, because it was what she read. That she gave me a love for family. That when my mom and I were living with her, at the time, she was housing three generations of my family. I later grew up to realize she had housed up to four at one point in time. And then I realized we weren't even related. We weren't related at all. She just loved on Johnsons. I'm one of the Johnsons. If you go to South Haven and you show this face, especially in the hospital, because my grandmother's worked in the, she's an institution in the hospital. My grandmother is like Elvis in South Haven, Michigan. You take her anywhere and what you'll hear is, Miss Johnson, you delivered my baby. Do you remember me? Miss Johnson, do you remember delivering me? Miss Johnson, we worked in the hospital together. Do you remember me? So when I showed up at the hospital to be with my grandfather who was very ill, I got, as I'm walking up, to say, could you tell, you must be a Johnson girl. I'm sorry, if you're from the city and you get you must be, you're thinking something is radically wrong, the police have called, my face is on a mugshot somewhere, something's bad, it's really, really bad. No one says, you must be a Johnson girl. So, but that's what life in South Haven, they're known. But Mother Bell, she modeled for me not just love, but she modeled for me what it meant to have what I just call a rock-solid love for God. I saw God as she cared for her husband alone at home for years as he was dying. He did not die quickly, and yet she faithfully loved on him that entire time, in addition to loving on the generations of my family that lived under her roof. I saw God as she cared for that garden, because she fed us with that garden. I saw God as she witnessed the truth of my family and my family members, and never once said a bad thing about any of us. Never once. And all around me, all around her, there were a whole lot of people saying a whole lot of bad things to me, about me, around me, and she was never one of them. And none of them ever had a bad thing to say about her, ever. She showed me what it really meant to know, I mean really know, and still love. A very godlike thing. Who else but God knows us and still really, really loves us. That's God. And yet she modeled that for me daily. I saw God as she loved me. Patiently, consistently, she lavished love on me day after day, all day for years. She never grew tired of my presence. She never grew weary or dismissive of my questions. And if you know me well, you know I got a lot of questions. I have questions about everything. She just loved me. I cannot wait to get to heaven to see her and say thank you. I never got to say thank you. I saw God as she followed the law and she rested on the Sabbath. I still don't even know what her religious affiliation was, but she rested every Sabbath. There was no work done in our house at all. That was the only day of the week where I would watch her put aside work for rest, for reading, for rocking, and for worship. And she did them all. Never did I feel like it was a legalistic act to her either, because she would invite me in to that time. I could sit with her. I could be with her. She would just bring me into this presence that she was sharing. So I could read with her, I could sing with her, I could stand with her, or I could sit quietly and just observe the whole process. But if I did, it was clearly inclusive. I was brought into something. I didn't know what the something was, but I knew I was being brought into something. She was unflappable. I would pose to her the most difficult 5-year-old questions I could come up with. And I remember one. At the time, my mom, we had lived with her for a few years, and my mom was newly married. I was visiting, and there was a new sister. And so I asked, or she asked me, how do you feel about your new baby sister? And, you know, because I felt no shame in her presence, I was very honest. I said, honestly, I don't think I like her. And can you take her back? Her comment was no. I mean, her answer was no. And she left it there. She didn't need to lecture me. She didn't need to explain to me what it meant to love. She didn't need to tell me how I really needed to embrace my new sibling and that there could possibly be others, little did she know. But she just left it with no. She could honestly trust, you know what, God will take care of all these things. You don't need to hear it from me. I saw faith modeled in that woman. I would have had a whole lecture on that one. In Mother Bell's home, I was acknowledged, I was safe, I was secure, I was loved, I experienced God. And for me in my five-year-old heart, and honestly in my 52-year-old heart, that house is the closest I've ever come to heaven on earth. Then enters a stepfather from 7 to 9. 2 years, really short time frame, 2 years. And yet, if Mother Bell's home was heaven, life with Ron, my stepfather, was coming to be hell. Because with Ron came some good. There did come good. He and my mom had 2 beautiful children within 14 months, my little sister and my little brother. But with Ron came every evil that stereotypically befalls a single mom and those who live in poverty. We went from living in this safe house outside of the inner city to moving straight to the ghetto. And my environment was then filled with alcohol, drugs, violence, abuse, and not only on the street, but it was in my house. And while my entire family most definitely suffered, as the oldest child, I took the brunt of the abuse that could be foisted on children. So, as a result, my happy little heart became home to confusion, to sadness, to depression, and to grave insecurity. I lost joy. As I look at pictures, I don't smile. I do not smile. I have not found a single picture that I smiled in, ever. I became sullen, moody, and reclusive. And yet, in the midst of all that horror, I still recall numerous times that all I could think to call it is deep meditation. I did not technically have any relationship with God that I'm aware of, other than Mother Bell. And yet I can recall times of what I can only refer to as meditation, where it just felt like Jesus called me away. That he would sing to me. He would take me someplace that wasn't inside my home. It wasn't around all these people. And yet, they were there. But somehow, I had a place where I was safe. As a result, I really don't remember. I don't have a multitude of horrific memories from those 2 years in my childhood. I have enough. But I don't have a host. That, to me, is God's kindness. God's kindness in allowing me to know him. Then after 2 years, Ron died. One night he was in our home inflicting evil that was his norm. And the next morning we awoke to a phone call from the police saying that he was found, he was dead, and the cause of his death, double pneumonia. But but he was perfectly healthy the night before. So in the 2 years of life with Ron, in 2 years of what I would call living in a place that I can only refer to as hell, I just think, wow, because evil is good. In 2 years, what somebody did in what probably took them only a few minutes of time, over a short span of time, they managed to set my life on a downward trajectory that lasted for 40 years. That's amazing. I mean, if we could make money like that, a couple minutes over a couple years, and you could make like crazy, exponentially, just think, or if we could do good that in minutes of time would have exponential results, I marvel at the effects of evil. I marvel. I mean, don't you? If you really think, that blows my mind. So, truly, the evil one himself used Ron and my life during that time to point it downward. That's powerful stuff, but God is more powerful still. Because 2 years, how long could it have lasted? To me, God intervened. Am I saying he took the man's life? I'm telling you, I don't know. I just know he was healthy last night. He's gone tomorrow. And it only lasted 2 years. I say in my soul, thank you, Jesus, for saving me. So Ron's death, my mom realizes, okay, you know, Chicago, clearly it's not a good place for me to raise my children. I have to leave. So again, the sacrifice of her dream, that's where they were. They were in Chicago. She left. She moved her children back to Michigan, to Ann Arbor, because she had a sister here. And once settled in an apartment, my mom found this little Baptist church that was close enough in walking distance. And so we all started to go to church. And even when we didn't go to church, my mom sent her kids to church. So I was always in church. But what I found in church was, again, that presence of God. It was like chocolate. You know? You know it, and it's good. And when you've been without it for a while, and you taste it again, it's like, that's yummy. I like it. I like it a lot. So as a result, if the church was open, I was there. I wasn't sure why I was there, but I was there. If it was going to open, I was there, or I was trying to get there. It also meant that when an evangelist came and he was going to have services and he started to talk about how, you know, Jesus came to save us from hell, I was on my seat and down the aisle. Now, granted, it wasn't that I was really so afraid of hell. It was that he also talked about God was going to save. The afterlife was nothing compared to my current life. So it was like, if Jesus has got the power to save in the hereafter, well, I bet he could do some serious hurt on what's going on today. So I'm all there. Sign me up. And so at 11 years old, I committed my life to Christ, and I never looked back. It was like, no, saving, I need it. I'm here. Take me, please. Does that mean that everything changed? Mercy, no. I wish it did, but it didn't. Does it mean that I suddenly understood? You know, as an 11-year-old, I understood. No, I still don't understand. Does it mean that that I never lose my footing? No. What it meant and means is that when I'm lost, I know where to go home. Home is not Mother Bell. Home is Jesus. It means that over the course of time, what God has shown me is that faith is very simple. Psalm 27:4 says, "One thing I've asked of the Lord, and that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and to meditate in his temple." Faith is simple. I had complicated it for many, 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 many years, especially as I grew up. And primarily, that was because of those 2 years. Those 2 years taught me some things about myself, or what I thought were things about myself. Really, they were lies. You know how you know good lie? Especially a lie straight from what I call the left side of the pit of hell? Is because it contradicts everything in Scripture. Everything. And if it contradicts Scripture, you can either choose to believe that, or you can choose to believe what stood the test of time to me, and that's the Bible, God and His Word. I'm there. It stands the test of time. Here's the lies I believed for 40 years. That I was, and they were built on. It's not like I got them all, you know, at age 7. Oh no, they added. So by the time I was 50, here's what I had. This is what I thought was true of me. That I'm void of talent and ability. I'm inferior. I'm broken beyond repair. I'm fearful. Just fill in the blank. Because I was fearful of everything. Joyless. I'm evil. I'm stained. I'm downright irredeemable. That I'm weak. I'm unwanted. Again, just look at your birth certificate. I'm insecure. I'm pessimistic. I'm disloyal. I can't hold on to anyone or anything. Everybody leaves. I'm overly emotional. I'm antisocial. I don't even like people. People don't like me. I'm flawed from birth. I'm 2-T-O-O. Fill in the blank. I'm just wrong. I was made wrong. I'm ugly, I'm unfriendly, and I'm unlovable. That was what the evil one taught me. And you know what? When he wasn't saying it, I'd just say it for him. Because I had learned it so well. So I'd speak it to myself. And so to cope, because you know, you wrestle. And especially if God's in your life, there's this hope that just bubbles up every once in a while. And you see through the dark and you realize it can't be this way. All these things that I think I hear about me, they can't possibly be true. They just can't be true. So I've got to do something. So to cope, you know, we come up with something. So sometimes you cope and you do very bad things. When you're trying to cope, when you're trying to relieve the pain, people in pain will do some crazy stuff. But people in pain will also do some really good stuff. So here's what, some of the things I did. I graduated with honors. In every company I ever worked, I was promoted. I won awards in music. I toured as the lead singer for several bands. I was a concert musician. I could pack out a concert hall. I was a teacher. I taught privately. I taught publicly. In public schools. I helped grow a PR firm from 2 people to 20 people. I helped make several companies multi-million dollars. I took several companies public. I finally earned the salary. I wore the clothes. I knew the people. And I drove the car that a poor little black girl from the ghetto had only dreamed about. I was active in my church. I was known, quote unquote. I was loved, quote unquote. And I was respected, quote unquote. I was volunteering for everything, saying no to almost nothing, and a friend to everyone. That's a coping skill. By no means was that a life. And still, every day, for 30, almost 40 years, I heard, I ran from, and I tried to deny the lies that the evil one kept whispering in my ear over and over and over again. And every lie negated every good thing that I ever accomplished. Again, the power of evil blows my mind. I've done some good things. And in those 52 years, I never celebrated one of them. Ever. I never appreciated any of them. If it makes me sorry, I just marvel at the sorrow that the heart of God must have felt, because those were good things that he was letting me experience, and I didn't enjoy them. I didn't know how. Until January of 2002. I have always journaled. I love to write. I think it's the coolest thing in the world, and somebody back there named Hannah has made me one of the coolest journals I've ever owned in my whole life. It's way cool. Handmade, awesome. So in January 2002, I'm writing in a journal, and I wrote this prayer. God, I need your help. I'm so tired of this life. Tired physically, tired emotionally, tired spiritually. I was working 100-hour weeks on average. That was normal for me, if you count my drive time. And I thought that was normal. but I was tired. I said, I have everything I want, have ever wanted, and yet I have nothing. I've tried to slow down, I've tried to make changes, and nothing works. Help me, God, please, please help me. That was January of 2002. On February 11th of 2002, at about 11:30 in the morning, God answered my prayer. That it was my custom on Saturday mornings to hang out with a girlfriend, that we would meet in the morning for prayer after I had run all my errands, cleaned my house, and exercised, you know, because you got a schedule. And I could do that by 11:30. Yes, I know, you're laughing because I am too. It was insane. It was absolutely insane. So truly, I get home, we come in, we sit down, we pour coffee, I look at my clock, I'm thinking, yeah, we're on time. And I look at her and I say, you know what? You need to call Joe and you need to call 911. And then my head hit the table. I had a massive stroke. That I had a hemorrhagic stroke in the cerebellum of my brain, right near the brainstem. And so she called 911, and when she called my husband, we lived in the city, so he was 45 minutes on the other side of town. We lived 15 minutes driving slowly from the nearest hospital. And so the ambulance arrives, and they start to work on me, but it was during flu season. And because I never lost consciousness with this stroke, I was having a seizure. I had vertigo so badly I couldn't open my eyes. But again, I'm anal. I'm type A. So as they're looking for a bowl and some towels, I'm laying with my head on the table going, no, go left, go up, go now, go right. No, not that drawer, the other one. I can't see what they're doing, but I'm totally right. I know my house. So the guys put me on the gurney. They take me downstairs, and they're thinking, this girl's got the flu. There's nothing wrong with her. She's fine. The truth is, I was dying. The other thing that was going on is that, again, I lost all function on the left side. I couldn't control my arm. I couldn't move my leg. I tried to get out of this chair before the ambulance arrived, thinking, okay, if I could just stand up, I'll be fine. So I literally put my leg down, and it was like watching a show. It just slid. It's like, then I thought, okay, I know there's napkins on this table somewhere, and I tried to open my eye in the room. So I thought, okay, close your eyes. You know where it is. Just reach. And then I hear this thing going, flappity, 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 flappity. It's my arm. It's my arm. I'm like, wow. So then I started to panic. And I'm, I'm thinking, oh Jesus, I'm dying. I'm dying. I think I'm dying. Oh Lord, I'm dying. Oh Lord, have mercy. I think I'm dying. I'm a Christian. I'm supposed to know what to do. I'm dying. What do people do with it? I don't know what to do with it. I'm dying. Oh God, help me. I'm dying. And then it occurred to me, wait a minute. I'm going to die. I'm going to land in heaven. It's probably quiet there. And when they hear me drop, then they're going to hear all this noise and everybody's going to turn. And they're just going to stare. Is this the way you want to enter heaven? So I got calm. And as I got calm, Psalm 23, out of nowhere, I still can't remember the last time I read Psalm 23 from top to bottom. And suddenly I'm quoting it. And it's all there. And I'm getting more and more calm. And I'm realizing, okay, well, you know, follow me all the days of my life and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So I guess that's where I'm going. So I'm good. So I can be quiet. All right. Okay. Yeah. And so I just continue to quote Psalm 23. The ambulance gets me to the hospital. I arrive 15 minutes after my husband, who has driven 45 minutes. Oh my gosh. The minute that they get me in there, the resident on duty, because it's a weekend, has just happens to have gone through his neurological rotation. He takes one look at me and says, we can't help her here. We're going to medvac her to a trauma unit in Baltimore. They immediately put me into a medically induced coma and put me on helicopter. And what they told my husband is, we'll let you drive to the hospital, and if she's alive when you get there, they'll tell you what they're going to do. Got me in the hospital. The doctors then looked at me, and they told my husband again, it's so close to her brainstem. She's bleeding internally. We can't even open her up to release the pressure. There'll be more swelling. She'll die. We have to wait. We can do nothing for her. So he waited. I woke up a couple of days later. And I remember trying, opening my eyes, focusing on people, and thankful the room wasn't moving too much, and trying to talk. I couldn't speak. I had all the words. They just wouldn't come out of my mouth. And I was thirsty. Because I had had tubes all in me. So I thought, I want something to drink. So I reached out. I'm right-handed, but I reached out my left hand because that was the free one. And it would move. And I thought, you know, my side really hurts. And I tried to turn. I couldn't turn. I lost all function. If you split me right down the middle, I lost everything. They took weeks to bring me back to normal, where I could speak. I still couldn't turn. So I went from 2 weeks in a hospital to being sent to a rehab hospital. And a rehab hospital, anybody ever seen a rehab hospital? They're just not cheery. You know, they're not cheery. Someone needs to really go in A and do a really good redecorating job. B, they need to tell you that if you're going into a rehab hospital under the age of 30, there might not be many people that will be in your peer group. So when I came in, and, you know, they believed in tough love. It was a good hospital. So when I came in, the nurse looks at me and she says, you know, you want dinner, you need to wheel yourself down. I'm thinking, lady, I can barely use my arm. Okay, nope, get in that chair and wheel yourself down. So I did. I got in there. I'm sweating bullets, and I get to the table, and I'm so excited. I'm going to eat. And I look over. There's a gentleman, at least 40 to 50 years my senior, looking at me, smiling, and going, little did he know, an instrument of God for me. Because I then asked the very next morning, how long do I have to be in this rehab hospital? And I was told, you should expect to be here anywhere from 2 weeks to over a month, just so that you can do the 5 activities of daily life. That's it. Just to get that 2 weeks to over a month. I was out in 10 days because he winked at me every meal. It was like, oh, I'm out of here. Trust me, I'm on the move. If they let me near that treadmill, I was on it. If they'd give me weights, I was lifting them. I am out of here. At the very least, I'm going to be able to punch in the nose if you come near me, one or the other. So yes, 10 days thanks to whoever he was. So in, out. As we were finishing up with rehab, I then had to go back to my neurosurgeon to tell me, okay, we haven't fixed anything yet. And I'm thinking, oh, really? No. No, we fixed nothing. Iris, here are the pictures. Let's start with the first picture. This first picture, this white area, this is your brainstem right here. This is the pool of blood that was on your brain. You are 3 centimeters from us never having this conversation. Oh, well, okay. So what was the problem? Well, the problem is a birth defect. You had an artery that connected to capillaries. They're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to have a cascading system that allows the pressure. I said, well, what's that like? He said, well, it would be similar to me taking the fire hydrant and hooking it up to a straw. It's not if the straw will break, it's when's the straw going to break with all that water coming through it. Oh, okay, so what do we do about that? Well, all the different kinds of schools of thought, if you want us to, we can operate to fix this. I'm thinking, what does that mean, really? It means plates, pins, you know, things that set off metal detectors. And I flew a lot, and I just thought, no. And at the time, I was wearing short hair. That would absolutely kill my look, don't you think? Plates and pins and all that kind of thing. So my first thought was, absolutely, most definitely not. I'm not doing that. So let's come up with an alternate plan. So his alternate plan was radiation. This is a new therapy that we've worked on. We've done it a lot here in Baltimore. We've definitely experienced success. It will surely work for you. It will take care of 80 to 90% of the problem. It will close those capillaries that are connecting to that artery, and they will reroute by themselves that blood flow. Well, yeah, I'm there. What it will mean, though, what does it mean? It means we're going to put a halo on your head. We're going to screw that bad boy in there. We're going to need to use a bunch of little needles in order to numb your skull while we do this. Sure. So we did this once. It takes a year for you to get the results because, again, it's the design, the process is such that it scars over, so the veins close. We did it once. I go back in. We do another angiogram. He tells me the results, and he says, you know, this normally works. This hasn't worked at all. Okay, so I've waited a year for nothing. And the other thing is, I could have died during that year, is what you're telling me. Oh, well, okay then. All right, so we need to do it again? Oh, okay, we'll do it again. So we did it again. And guess what? It didn't work. So at that point, I thought, okay, it's about 2004. Remember, I'm moving. So we moved. And again, you come close enough to death, you're at peace with God. My thought was, you know, maybe everybody will forget and I won't need to even take this little test again because really, absent from the body is present with the Lord. I'm good now. I won't be the law black woman arriving in heaven. So this is all good. I'm not going to take the test ever again. So we get to Michigan and my husband remembers, aren't you due for another angiogram? Yes. Well, I need for you to take it. Are you kidding me? I need for you to do this. Love says I'll go. So I go. And we get another angiogram. And the doctor shows it to us. And he says, you know, he says, no evidence that there's ever been any scarring. But he said, do you see that bubble here on this vein? And do you see the bubble here on this one? He said, the real issue now is not if you'll have another stroke, it's when. And I can't promise you. He said, what I can tell you is it'll be bad, but I can't promise you that you'll die. It's like, whoa. It has taken me years to even function with a deficit. You're telling me I won't die? I could be worse off than I was? That was terrifying. That is terrifying to me. That's terrifying. So I then said, okay, well, what do you want to do? His comment was, you need to do an embolization. We're going in. So I currently have, what do you call it? Medical super glue and mesh wire in my brain. Truly. It's amazing. Amazing what they can do. Truly. But it worked. It absolutely worked. God, sparing my life for years. Because I had no idea there were little bubbles on veins in my brain that could go poof. And at the same time, what God also did is he gave me a network that's filling that one of those rows back there of people that sustained me through. Because truly, I was terrified. Absolutely terrified. And I was not afraid that I would die. I was afraid I would live. And I was afraid I would live and that all those lies would find me again in the silence. And yet, what God did was doing in all of that silence, all of that rehab, all of that quiet. Because when you can't walk, you can't move, you can't drive, you can't turn, you can't wipe your rear, you can't do any of the things that you used to do. The thing you confront is who you are. And the thing you confront is who you thought you were. And you realize, so you're worth suddenly this. I was worth nothing to me. So in all of that silence, God began to tell me truth. Truth. That I may know him. He allowed me to know him. And he allowed me to be quiet long enough. He helped me be quiet long enough so I could hear him. I didn't know how loud I am. I'm really loud. I say a lot. I use a lot of words very often. Sometimes I am learning it's not that God doesn't speak to me. It's that I'm never quiet enough to hear. It's not that God doesn't want my attention. It's that I make him try to keep up. You know? It's like trying to text and drive at the same time. You don't do either one really well. So, God in his kindness, honestly, I do not believe he caused my stroke. I do not believe that any of the evil that befell me came from my father. I do believe he allowed it. I do believe he eased it. And I do believe that his plan always has been that time thing that I might know him. I believe now that my perspective is so changed because my goal is to see each thing that happens as my Savior saying, come, come close. Just come close. It feels really squeezy. You feel like you're blocked like the Israelites between the Egyptians and the Red Sea. And my phrase to myself now is, Lord, you see me. And you're right. It's about to get good. The Red Sea is about to part. It's about to get good because you got nothing else. Look up. Help is coming if you're inviting Jesus in. Help is on the way. It may not look like what you wanted. It may not be what you wanted. I promise you a stroke was not on my wish list. And I promise you that when we went back after that successful embolization, 3 mini strokes were not on my wish list because they took out the right side. I was like, I was just getting good on the right. What do you mean take it out? God and I really had to talk about that. I don't even know how you position that. I lost everything on the right with 3 mini strokes after embolization. And what's even more interesting to me is that on the way to, or after an angiogram, what was on the way to that angiogram, I was tense. I've had 8 of these things by that point. I knew how to do it. I knew what to expect. They were really in the whatever. I had no idea. I was so nervous. And so in the car, as Joe's driving, I'm praying. I'm like, okay, God, what is up? And I just felt like God was saying, you need to say yes. You just need to say yes. Say yes. You need to say yes. That you'll walk with me no matter what. So between Dundee and U of M, I said yes. Okay, God, whatever. Whatever you bring. I'll walk with you. I will walk. So when the doctor's saying, how are you feeling? And I try to say, I'm fine. And it won't come out. I looked at him and I blinked. And to the best of my ability, without a right side of my face, I smiled. And he looks, and he goes, oh, no, no, no. It must just be that you're having someone. I was like, because that's the best I could give him. He then stayed with me, and he looked at me at one point, and he said, you don't understand. I've done 1,500 of these, and this has never, ever happened. I can't tell you why this happened to you. I'm thinking, I do. I said yes. Sorry, babe, that you have to be a part of this, but come on. It'll be all right. God in that moment, for me, in that next 6 months of rehab, was reminding me, Iris, all the things I've taught you, all the things I've showed you about who I am, don't forget. Don't let go because you're getting your life back and your skills back and your habits back and your pace back. Don't let go. You know things about life and yourself and love and relationships and what's really important and what's not important. Don't change. Don't let go. Come. just calm. Because you know where love really is. You know where your peace really lies. You know the secrets. You know joy. Come. Come. So again, Philippians 3:10. For my determined purpose is that I may know him, that I may progressively become more deeply and intimately acquainted with him, perceiving and recognizing and understanding the wonders of his person more strongly and more clearly, and that I may in that same way come to know the power outflowing from his resurrection, which it exerts over all believers, and that I may so share his sufferings as to be continually transformed in spirit into his likeness, even to his death, in the hope that if possible, I may attain to the spiritual and moral resurrection that lifts me out from among the dead, even while in this body. I love that. And then last, another verse that I adore is Romans 8:38 and 39. It says, I'm convinced that nothing can ever separate us from God's love. Neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither our fears for today nor our worries about tomorrow. Not even the powers of hell can separate us from God's love. No power in the sky above or in the earth below. Indeed, nothing in all creation, which includes me, will ever be able to separate us from the love of God that is revealed in Christ Jesus our Lord. So for me, at the points where life's circumstances seem to most threaten to destroy me, physically, emotionally, spiritually, for me, in those times I've seen the greatest expressions of God's presence and the power that he actively brings to bear in my life, so that he can work this verse slowly, massaging it deeply into my soul. And while I think that's awesome, I mean, I really do, I think it's absolutely awesome, I don't think that my life is special, because God is. So any working that he's done in this soul, I believe he does in every soul, or he sure wants to. And then some. That this much understanding have I. How much more could God do in so many more? So, thank you.